Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Iaconelli.
Okay, our time's up. Hey, it's great to be with you, and I'm excited to be a part of this. And I have to tell you, this one is the seminar I've been most looking forward to. It's the title of my new book, which won't be out for another 4 years, but I'm working on it. And this is the one I'm most scared to talk about because the title of it is called Impersonating Ourselves. And my basic thesis is that we all, whether we like it or not, or whether we admit to it or not, are in the business of impersonating ourselves. And the hardest thing that we can learn in the Christian faith is not to stop smoking and stop drinking. Those are certainly important if that's what you feel God is telling you to do. But what's most important is that we learn how to be real. And so this seminar is somehow going to try to deal with that whole issue of not being real. Because I'm convinced, I've been working with kids now for 42 years, and I'm convinced that what young people are saying to me is, look, it's not that I don't want to know Jesus or God or get religious or have spirituality or anything else. I just want people to be real. I wanted to be honest. I was at a church in Hawaii. I was over there doing mission work. I was for myself. And we were over there. By the way, I have a philosophy about that, and I'm just going to say it. I've already told my kids, there's no inheritance money for you. You get absolutely nothing. We're spending every dime of it before we get too old to enjoy it. And we're not saving it for you. So when we get enough money to go to Hawaii, we go. Because I'm not going to wait till I'm 80 years old with a big hat riding and a big tour bus going, aloha. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go there so I can sit inside because I can't get in the water. I'm going to go now when I can still be able to do that. So anyway, I was over in Hawaii, and I was after I'd done a little seminar, somebody came up to me and said, would you speak at our church tomorrow? And I said, sure, I'd love to. And I said, what's the name of your church? And they said, well, it's the Japanese Holiness Church of Hawaii. Wow, I had never been to a Japanese Holiness Church. I didn't know there was such a thing. And I started thinking in my mind, what is this church like? Are they all, Japanese are usually kind of quiet and reserved. And I thought, and this is a charismatic church, so how does that look? I had no idea. I was really kind of nervous about it. So I get to the church, and it's really pretty normal all the way through. And it's time for the sermon. And I get up to do my sermon. And they introduce me, and I'm about 5 minutes into my sermon when suddenly, somewhere in the audience, I hear, ah! And nobody looks. Nobody does anything. They're just looking at me. And I think, I guess that's the charismatic thing. I guess one samurai just yells it out. I don't know. So I just keep on going. I figure, okay, everything's fine. I start going on, and I get about 5 more minutes into it. Ah! Again, nobody stops. Nobody looks. It's like everybody knows what's going on. I have no clue. So I continue to speak. One more time, I hear, ah! And all of a sudden, I feel a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's the Japanese minister, and he kind of does this and pushes me out of the side, and he goes, Charlie, shut up! Turns out Charlie's a member of this church, and he's got some mental problems, and they've gotten used to it, and he's welcome in their church, and he's safe to be there, and they all just every once in a while, after he does this 2 or 3 times, you have to get up and tell him to shut up. Well, I wish somebody would have told me. I'm thinking it's cultural. I'm thinking it's this. I'm thinking it's that, and no one had whatever it was, they just forgot to come up to me and say, by the way, during your sermon, somewhere along the way, Charlie may yell or scream. I wish they would have told me that. Would have made my life so much easier. I have a feeling that a lot of us out here live in this world where we are continually asked to impersonate ourselves. I have a great little list of things that you know, when you get to be an adolescent, you worry about. Worry that if you kiss too much, you'll get mono. Worry that while making out, you ought to be saying things like, oh, baby. Worry that in a long kiss, you'll have to breathe through your nose and your nose will be stopped up. Worry that your breath smells. Worry that everyone is in on the joke but you. Worry there's a right way to dress and you don't know it. Worry there's a right way to kiss and you don't know it. Worry that your date can tell you don't know it. If you're a girl, worry that you won't have breasts. If you're a guy, worry that you will. Worry that your nose is too fat. Worry that your lips are too long. Worry that your neck is too fat. Worry that your ears stick out. Worry that your eyebrows are too close together. And if you're a boy, worry that you'll never grow a mustache. And if you're a girl, worry that you will. And this is the one that totally freaks me out. Worry that when you go to the bathroom, someone will hear. The reality is all of us are scared to death to be ourselves, to be honest, to be real. And it turns out that in the church, you would think of all places, this is where we can find people who are real. I've been in the ministry now for a long time. And I have to tell you that in these years of being in the ministry, I've watched a lot of people crash and burn. I had a good friend of mine who was my boss, actually, married, two kids, absolutely incredible guy. After working with him for like 15 years, it turned out he was gay. He just died of AIDS. His family didn't know. His kids didn't know. None of us who worked for him knew. And yet for all these years, he'd been living this unbelievable lie. I have another friend of mine who was a chaplain to one of the highest people up in government. And for 18 years, this pastor of a really huge, gigantic church had been having an affair with somebody in the church. 18 years. Nobody knew. Nobody had a clue. The reality is that I have a good friend, a woman who is, she's been a good friend for about 15 years. And we were at her house one night. She said, look, I want to play this tape for you. And it was a tape of her talk that she gave at her church the last week. And in that tape, she confesses that for the last 6 years, she'd been an alcoholic. Her husband didn't know. Her children didn't know. No one knew. I'm convinced that all of us in this place carry around with us secrets. We carry inside of us deep longings. We carry inside of us a past, a history of hurts or brokenness or something. And somehow we stuff it. We put it down. We are all mysteries, and we are all more than we appear. And I would like to talk about that today. And I think there's lots of reasons why this is true. The first is we're just too busy. The reality is that in order for me to get to know you and to spend time with you, I have to take time to do it. Friendships require a great deal of time. Getting to know each other requires time. And for most of us in this place, it's not that we drink too much or we party too much. You may do that. But that's not what keeps us from getting to know each other or being real. What keeps us from getting to know each other is we are too busy. I was sitting with my son. I have five children, and my oldest son is 36 right now, and my second oldest is 35. And he just had a new baby. And he didn't, his wife did, but he was there. And he contributed to this, and the baby's name was Wilder. What a great name. We're in deep trouble, but what a great name. And afterward, he and I were sitting out in the backyard, and we were talking and just having this incredible conversation, talking about life, talking about my mom. And he looks at me and he says, you never talk about your mother. My mother died 20 years ago. He said, why don't you ever talk about her? I said, I don't know. And he looked at me, and his eyes kind of got watery, and he said, Dad, I love talking about life with you. And I started crying. And I thought to myself, my kid is 35 years old. I have been with this kid for 35 years. And I'll bet you we've had maybe 1, 2, 3 hours of serious, significant, meaningful life conversations. And I suddenly realized that my life was speeding by so fast that I didn't even know my children. And my children didn't even know me. And I'm suggesting to you that if the Christianity is true, if the faith is true, if Jesus is who he said he was, it's not just that we're witnessing to the world, it's that we're learning how to be real with each other. We're learning how to take the time to get to know each other. There's a lot of you here who have been married for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and you do not know the person you're married to. You know, I get to do weddings. None of them are legal, but I get to do them. And when I sit down with these couples, you have to do marriage counseling. Now, I don't have a lot of faith in marriage counseling. I'm going to be honest with you. I just don't believe that you can sit with a couple who's in heat, who are kind of looking at each other like this, panting after each other, and say, you know, you just did a survey, and you don't match. You really shouldn't do this. And have them go, okay, we'll just call it off. I mean, it's not going to happen. I hope the best I can do is to say some things that when they get married, they'll remember. But it always blows me away. How do you realize that so many couples today live together because they believe that if you live together, then you get to know them. And then when you get married, there won't be any surprises. There is no way that you and I don't care how long we live together, there's always surprises. There's always stuff that shows up. There's always stuff that I've kept inside. And the issue is for all of us in the church, not am I running around telling people about Jesus, but can people see in me a reality and a truth and an honesty and an authenticity that they can go, you know what? That person is flawed and they're messed up, but they're real. They tell the truth. And that's what ought to be in church. Church ought to be the one place where people tell the truth. And if you can't tell the truth, there's no point in going. There's no point in sitting in church playing these games. Let's just be honest about it. Wouldn't it be great if your minister got up one Sunday morning and said, you know, on the way to church, my wife and I had one hell of a fight. And it was really a bad argument. In fact, my wife is still so ticked off at me, she's down in the nursery right now. She doesn't want to look at me. And frankly, I'm glad she's in the nursery because I don't want to look at her. And to be honest with you, I'm so upset, I don't feel like preaching this morning. So why don't you folks take it? I'm going home. Now, wouldn't somebody in the church just want to stand up and go, woohoo! They fight! I knew they did! Now, if he does it every Sunday, you might want to get him into some counseling. But once in a while, that would be so refreshing to hear. It's that honesty and reality that I'm talking about. And there's so much impersonation that goes on. A lot of it simply because we're too busy. The second reason that we impersonate ourselves is that we think all this stuff inside of me will go away. If I just watch enough TV, if I just read enough books, if I go to enough movies, if I just get distracted, if I just keep from looking and trying to think about what's going on, then it'll just go away. But I want to tell you something, it never goes away. It only goes deeper. And it begins to affect everything I do, whether I talk about it or not. So you might as well just realize it's never going to go anywhere. I might as well just begin to face it and deal with it right now. The reality is for a lot of us in this place, we don't want to look at all the stuff in our life, and so we just basically pretend it isn't there. Thirdly, maybe one time you tried. You ever had that experience where somebody says to you, hey, how you doing? And you go, man, I am really doing terrible. And they go, great, good to see you. You're going, they weren't listening. They didn't even care. And often, sometimes people will say, man, you really look upset. And you go, man, I am. And they say, what's wrong? And you start to say it, and you can see that they're looking at their watch, that they want to get going, that they've already checked out, that they don't want to listen. And so you finally decided, what's the point? If I really am honest, if I really tell people who I am, they're not going to listen to me, and they're going to turn me off, so forget it. You've been burnt so many times when you tried that you just thought, all right, I'm not trying anymore. What is it that separates the church from every other institution? It's the one place where you can go and people will listen to you. Okay, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. You don't need a sermon. You don't need somebody pulling out their Bible. You don't need a tape on how to turn your scars into stars. You don't need a positive thinking thing. You don't need anything. You just need somebody who will listen and hear what's going on inside of you and really do seem to care. Isn't the most sad story in the Bible where Jesus is in the garden and he's praying and he's sweating drops of blood and the disciples are asleep and he can't wake them up? We have a whole culture that's asleep to who you and I are. There's a bunch of young people here. You're going through hell right now. And you're playing the game and you're pretending like everything's great, but it's not great. And you haven't found anyone that you can sit down to talk with to say, look, I don't want a lecture. I don't need your advice. I just need to share with you what's going on inside of me. I want you to know that's who Jesus is. He's got all day. But it's not just Jesus. It has to be us as well who listen. Fourthly, we're afraid. We're scared to death to share who we are because if I really tell you what I'm like, I'm afraid that you won't like me. I'm afraid you'll be disillusioned. I'm afraid that from that point on, you won't want to talk to me or be with me or listen to me or hear what I have to say. In fact, a friend of mine asked me to write an article on praying. It was a book, and not an article. It was a book, and everybody was supposed to write about prayer, and he had all these really heavy-duty prayers, you know, really cool people writing in the book, and he asked me to write, and I thought, I don't pray very much, and I'm not a very good prayer. So I thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to fake this one? And I figured, well, they won't know who I am in this book, so I'm just going to say what I really think, and here's what I wrote. I've always been terrible at praying. I forget. I fall asleep. I don't pray enough. I don't understand what prayer is or what prayer does. If prayer were school, I would flunk praying. But prayer isn't school. It's a mystery. Maybe the mystery is that Jesus loves terrible prayers. Prayer is a mystery, a maddening, glorious, frustrating, irritating, and invigorating conversation with God. Maddening because we don't understand how prayer works, frustrating because our prayers often seem to go unnoticed, irritating because God always seems to answer other people's prayers. Don't ask me for healing because everybody I prayed for healing, they died about a week later. This is not a good thing. Invigorating because despite our ignorant and inconsistent prayers, God shows up in our praying. What if the mystery of prayer is that when I can't think of anything to say, Jesus says what I can't say? What if when I talk too much, he cherishes my too many words? What if when I fall asleep, he holds me in his lap and caresses my weary soul? What if when I'm overwhelmed with guilt at my inconsistent, inadequate praying, Jesus whispers, "Your name is always on my lips"? I just decided it was about time I just admitted that I'm not the greatest prayer in the world. I hope that hasn't disappointed you. I hope you understand that there are some people that have great gifts of praying. I'm not one of them. I don't know if I'm ADD. Everybody seems to be nowadays. But all I know is my mind's flitting around like this, and I'm always doing this, and I have a friend of mine who goes to month-long spiritual retreats. He's silent for a month. I can't imagine such a thing. It's either a retreat or it's hell. It's one or the other. He goes to this retreat for 30 days. The guy prays for hours. It's unbelievable. And we're sitting down having a conversation with this guy. And I said to him, "You make me feel guilty because I don't pray." And he got really mad at me. He said, "Yaconelli, shut up." He said, "I'm a priest. I'm supposed to pray. I don't have 5 children. I don't have a wife. I'm just by myself." He said, "I've always been a loner. I've always been by myself. And when I'm praying, I'm not always praying. I'm taking a nap. I'm taking a walk. I'm looking at things. I'm doing this and that." He said, "You just think I'm praying because I'm a priest." He said, "I know you pretty well. You're always thinking about God." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, that's prayer, so shut up." I'm telling you, you and I, when we get honest with each other, when we finally just lay it out how we feel and who we are and what's going on inside, it's amazing how God shows up to affirm that there are other people out there who are just like us. I wrote a book called Messy Spirituality, and I wanted the byline to be Christianity for the rest of us. I just wanted to say there's some of us out there that people, we think we're crazy. We hear a sermon and everybody comes out going, "Whoa." And we're going, "What was that?" And we don't want to say anything. And we think it must be me. I guess I'm crazy. I guess there's something wrong with me. I guess I wasn't listening. I guess I should be more spiritual. I guess I should let God. Because we're scared to death that if people really know who we are. I saw this little boy down here and he has to listen to my talk. I'm sorry. Mom made you come and that's the way it is. God wanted you here. I still have gum in my mouth. Excuse me. I'll get it later. We in our church, we don't have a nursery because we like the kids just to kind of run around. And they do. And they make noise, which is wonderful. I think it's the noise of love. It's the noise of the, I mean, it ought to be there. Little children ought to be free to kind of, I mean, they can't understand everything I'm saying. You, of course, understand everything I'm saying. But they don't. And I'm sitting there one Sunday morning. And this guy came to church. He hadn't been in church in a long time. And he brought his son who'd never been in a church in his life. And he was kind of noisy and walking around and asking questions at the wrong time. And then I got up to do my talk. And as I'm talking, you can see that I have to use my hands and all kind of thing. I'm Italian. And if I didn't use my hands, I'd be constipated. And so I'm just moving around like this. And the next thing you know, I notice that everybody in the church is looking to their right. And they're not looking at me, obviously. And I look up, and here's this young boy standing in the front row. And everything that I do, he's doing. I'm going like this. He's going like this. And everybody is just fascinated and watching him. And his dad is kind of embarrassed, and he's going, look over here, quit doing that. And I said, no, that's fine, that's great, because that means he's listening. And that's how four-year-olds listen. They get into it and they find a way to use their body to kind of, he's not understand what I'm saying, but he's this or he's Italian, one or the other. And the reality was that it became a really neat thing. You know how like we have signing for the deaf? It was the same kind of thing, only he was signing for all the adults who have become boring. And to just sit there stone-faced like that. This young man had broken through and found a way to be real, to be himself. And of course, we have Sadie, the Down syndrome girl in our church, who always does the same thing. She's just amazing at being able to be real and to be honest. I spoke about Britney Spears one time. I did a lot of research. And I was talking about how she's so intimidating to the rest of women and men as well, because she's just so foxy and so good looking and all this. And I said, most of us are not. And to be honest, every time we hear about her, we feel really bad about ourselves. And it's not that she's making us feel bad intentionally. It's just the way it is. We just don't have bodies like that. And frankly, I'm 61. And I don't want a body like hers, but I'm at the point where I'm going, I deserve what's left of this body. I don't have to go to fitness thing every other week. It's not going to help all that much. It may be firm, but it'll be wrinkled. What's the difference? So I'm talking about Britney Spears, and one of the things over, Sadie comes up to me, and she's just weeping because she's kind of overweight. She said, you were so right. You know, Britney makes me feel bad because I'm not pretty and I never will be and I'll never have a boyfriend. Gosh, it was just gut-wrenching. She was so honest. And I sat down with her and I could just feel myself getting into the counselor dad thing, you know. And I'm going, Sadie, that's okay. You know, just be honest with me. Just share your feelings. And, you know, beauty is much deeper than da-da-da-da-da. I'm going on and on. All of a sudden, she just stops and looks at me and goes, okay, Mike, you can go now. I said, what do you mean I can go now? I'm not done yet. She said, well, I am. You said everything I need to hear. Goodbye. And she sent me off, and I thought, how refreshing. I wish everybody I counseled would do that. I wish people would be honest enough to say, yeah, that's enough. I've heard all I need to know. And walk out. But instead, we all play these games. But thank God for Sadie, who hasn't learned how to do that yet. And then there are a lot of us who are just flat out angry. The reason we're impersonating ourselves is that if we really started telling the truth, if we really started getting into who we are, we would get so angry that we're afraid our anger would somehow erupt and hurt us in a bad way. You know what, folks? Every once in a while, it's okay to get angry. We need to get angry sometimes. There are things worth getting angry about. And when you're abused, there's nothing wrong with getting angry about that. You can't live in it the rest of your life. The anger will end up destroying you. But there are points at which you do have to get angry. And you do have to say, that is it. I remember the first convention that I have a little company that trains youth workers. And our first National Youth Workers Convention, we had a speaker get up. He was a missionary. And he got up and he said, I want to tell you all here that when you work in the ghetto, when you work in the urban areas, you don't have to get the kid out of the ghetto. You just have to get the ghetto out of the kid's heart. And a guy stood up in the audience and went, bullshit! This was our first conference and our last. And everybody was just stunned. They just went, gah! And a huge argument ensued because he was saying, excuse me, we may want to get something out of their heart, but we also want to get them out of the ghetto, right? And I don't believe what you're saying. And this guy goes, well, no, I didn't mean that. I mean, what I meant was, bam, bam, this is like this. And people are running all around, and there's all these arguments, and finally we just had to dismiss. And that was wonderful. That's the way it should have ended. That's the way it should have gone. We didn't have to finish the agenda. You know, every time you go to church, there's always an agenda. And everything has to squeeze into this little agenda, and so we want to make sure that we've got time to do everything. It's just like my speaking here, and we had two things before, and everybody's going, okay, you've got to speak, you've got to hurry up, go ahead, you can take a little bit longer, it's all right. I don't have to take longer, it's fine. That's why I had them come, I didn't have that much to say. The reality is that we have all these agendas that end up getting set for us, and because they're all out there without us even knowing it, the next thing you know, we're unable to really speak and say what we really wanted to give a testimony or to get up and share, or it's prayer time and I want to get up and say, hey, I need prayer right now, and I need prayer right this second. Would you folks please just lay hands on me and pray for me right now? It's not time yet. We'll be happy to do that later in our hands praying room over to the right. The reality is that for all of us, that's what we're looking for. We want to be able to tell the truth, to be able to be real, to be who we are. Another thing is we get embarrassed. We just get embarrassed because sometimes the stuff in our lives is embarrassing. We just do dumb things. I travel a lot, and when you travel a lot, you get picky. And you get kind of exactly where the seat you want and how you want to be in that plane and how it all works. And you get mad when they want to check you 3-4 times, especially when all the security stuff, it just drives you crazy. And I have to be honest with you, I'm not very patient. It's godly impatience, but it's, okay, it's just flat out road rage. But the fact is, I'm frustrated. So anyway, I was late. My plane got there late, the connection. I'm running like crazy to the gate. I get to the gate. I give them the ticket. I run in. I'm sitting in my seat right there. I sit down in my seat. It's a really good seat. I was able to get upgraded. So I was sitting in first class, and I was right there on the aisle seat. And I made the plane. I was sweating. And I took out my book, and I was reading it. And I'm just reading away. And all of a sudden, there's somebody standing right there. And I'm ignoring them. I look out of the corner of my eye, and it looks like somebody looking at their ticket like they've got the same seat. And so I just sit there, ignoring them. So pretty soon, I notice he's gone. He comes back with the flight attendant. They're both standing there. I'm ignoring them still. I realize that they're going to ask me for my ticket, so without them even saying a word, I pull out my ticket stub and just hold it up like that and keep reading. I'm ignoring them. I'm not going to deal with this. And the woman takes the ticket, and they both leave. So I figure, okay, thank you very much. We've taken care of the problem. Pretty soon, the flight attendant comes back. And everybody now is watching. The whole cabin is looking at me. And I'm sitting there, and she comes up, and she said, "Sir, are you going to Medford, Oregon?" I said, "Yes, I'm going to Medford, Oregon." She said, "This plane's going to Seattle." You could just feel everybody around me going, "Yes!" It was so humiliating, so embarrassing. I had to take my bags out to walk. I'm sorry, but I had to walk out of there. I look like a complete idiot. I've never flown that airline again. But I'm telling you, it's tough when you realize that the world out there is so cruel. Those of you that have any kind of impairment, your ear is out of shape, or your nose is a little too big, or your hips are too big, or whatever, people notice, and you know they notice. And you can hear them when you went to school. They used to make fun of you. They used to talk about it. When you get old, they do the same thing. They notice your little belly that sticks out. And they talk about it when you're not there. The world can be so cruel to people. And it's no wonder that a lot of us go, "I'm not going to subject myself to this. I just can't do it. I'm not going to do it." Even in church. We have this one guy in our church. He's an alcoholic. He's in and out of jail. He's had a rough life. He used to be a Hell's Angel. He took a lot of drugs that kind of messed him up a little bit. He's pretty amazing. And he comes to church and, you know, has us pray for all this stuff. And he's been through a couple of marriages. And he's just, you know, kind of hanging in there. Big guy. He walks up to me at one of our church events. And he said, "You know, I can sing." I said, "Oh, good. That's great, Mike. I'm really glad to hear that." He says, "No. I really have a good voice. And in fact, I'd like to sing tonight." I said, "You mean in the program that we already have got scheduled?" "Yeah." "Well, do you need any?" "No, I'm going to sing a cappella." "Okay." So Mike sings that night. I'm here to tell you, your worst dreams could not have thought how bad this was. When you sing a cappella, you ought to have some sense of tune or where to start. He started incredibly high at the beginning, and the chorus went really high. And he is just screaming at the top of his lungs. I don't even remember the words. It was something about "there's only one." And it was just, "What?" And the veins in his neck were like, I swear to God, I thought he was going to blow out a testicle. I mean, this guy... It was a train wreck. And he finally gets done with the song. And when he does, honestly, you could feel the whole group just kind of go, "Thank God that was over with." We all just kind of walked out sort of in shell shock. About a month later, he comes up to me in church one Sunday morning. He said, you know how I sang for the church event? I said, yeah. I said, well, I'd like to sing again. Only I probably was not very good without accompaniment, so I've learned how to play the guitar. And I'm going to sing this morning. Okay. So I introduced him, and you can just see the look of terror on people's faces. He gets up with the guitar, and he actually begins to strum real chords. He's got to really look hard, and it takes him a little longer than normal, but he gets the chords, and he sings along with the chords, and he's so nervous that he's shaking, and he's looking down at the floor, but by golly, he gets through the whole song, and it's kind of in tune, and it sort of works, and when he's done, again, you could just feel the whole audience just go, oh, way to go, much better. They gave him a little applause, like polite applause. About a month later, he comes and says, I want to sing again. And you know the piano player? She's been working with me for about 2 weeks, and so we'd like to sing. And she's going to play for me. I said, okay. And I'm here to tell you, one of the greatest memories of my life will be the morning that Mike Green sang that song. It was still a little off tune. It wasn't great. But it was such an amazing gift and such an amazing improvement over what he'd done up until then. And I thought to myself, if Mike can't sing in church, then where can he? I mean, isn't the church the one place that people like Mike Green can sing, even if they can't sing? Because the church is willing to say, go ahead, sing. I know you're off tune, but that kind of makes it kind of neat. It kind of works into the rest of it, and it's kind of great. I mean, we like to hear people who can sing on tune, but once in a while, it's nice to hear somebody who gives it all they've got. And who tries as hard as they could. And I'm so excited that Mike Green had the courage to say, I'm not going to impersonate myself. I'm going to do this. I'm going to sing and be who I am, who God made me to be. There's some other reasons why we do this, why we continue to impersonate ourselves. But I do want to see if I can figure out a way to respond to this. How do you and I get to the place where we can start being honest and being real? Okay, first thing. And you're going to go, wow, I want to write this down because this is amazing truth that I know you came to hear. Start telling the truth, duh. Just start doing it. Start being honest. You don't have to be blunt. You don't have to be mean. You don't have to be hurtful, but you can tell the truth. How are you doing? I'm not doing well. How's it going? It's not going well. Or if it is going well, say that too. And have you ever had that happen where you really had something neat happen, but you didn't want to tell anybody because you knew they'd be all envious and mad? You wanted to come in and go, man, I just had the need. I fell in love with the most amazing woman. And your friend who's never had a woman is going, oh, good for you. Thanks for rubbing my nose in it. The reality is that you and I have to start telling the truth. And that's what ought to characterize the church. We're people who tell the truth. That's the deal. That's the way it is. Secondly, recognize that tiny things matter. Little things matter. I just preached a sermon in my church called Thaddeus the Nobody. Thaddeus was one of the disciples. He had like four names, so you never know who you were talking about. Often when you read the Bible and you see in there Judas, not Iscariot, that's Thaddeus. Well, if you had a name like Thaddeus, Judas sounds better to me. So Thaddeus, Judas, whatever his name was, he's only mentioned once in the Bible, and that's when he asked a question, and we never hear from him from that point on. And we live in a world where everybody is always looking for their 15 minutes of fame, where they're trying to be somebody for just a little bit, where somebody can notice them, even if it's ridiculous, even if it's on these reality shows, even if they're made to look like a fool. If they have 15 minutes of fame, they think, wow, I've really made it. Well, let me tell you, Jesus came to say to us, look, I'm not about you getting famous, about you becoming a celebrity, about you being well-known. I came for the nobodies. I'm the God of the nobodies. I'm the God of the people who nobody hears about. And we have a crowd full of people that you basically are just getting through your life. And that is so courageous and so heroic and so unbelievable. If people knew the kind of life you were really being asked to live, if they knew your family, if they knew the circumstances and the fact that you're actually at Greenbelt. Some of you had to get to Greenbelt even though your mom and dad said, you go to Greenbelt, they're mad at you, they wouldn't give you the money, you found a way to get here, you snuck through the gate, and we know who you are, we've got you here. You said, I'm going there. My mom and dad don't get it. They don't understand, but I'm going to go, and I'm going to be a part of this thing, and I'm going to get there. And because you did that, Jesus is looking at you going, I am so proud of you. You are so amazing. It's the nobodies. It's the people who do the little things. Maybe you have three children and you gave up a career and you gave up your job to take care of those kids and it killed you and you miss your career and you miss all that, but you love your kids and you've decided, by God, that's what I'm going to do and great for you. And others of you have said, I'm going to have to leave my baby to go back to my career because we don't have enough money to live and it's killing me, but I'm going to do it anyway. And every day that I'm at work, I hate it, but I'm there anyway because I wanted to be with my child. And God is looking at you going, thank you. That you love your child so much that you're willing to do this. You see, I'm convinced that most of us think God is in the business of catching us all the time doing something wrong. That's what God is about. I gotcha. Because I can see your thoughts. That was a nasty one. That goes against, there's one check. Two more and you're dead. We honestly believe that God gets great pleasure out of finding us, catching us in a sin, catching us doing something wrong. When in fact, what kind of a God would that be? God is the God who celebrates who we are. He celebrates every step we make. When I taught our kids to walk, when they took their first steps, you know, you get the camera, you got grandma, you got everybody there, and you're going to walk, walk, come on, and they kind of walk two or three steps, look like they're drunk, and they kind of fall down. You don't go, oh, nice job. Grandma hasn't even figured out the digital camera yet, and you're falling down. Get up and walk again, and don't fall. We have this view of God, like, you know, we take through three steps, and we fall down, and we think God's going, oh, great, that's really nice. Yeah, big Christian you are. Oh, what a commitment you made. Oh, yeah, I'm going to give my life to Jesus. And you just fell, get up! Instead of God looking at you going, three steps, nice job. Really good, you were a little out of balance, but you did really good. And it takes those kind of falling downs in order for us to understand how you walk. You know, learning how to be a Christian, following Christ is not easy. Look at the disciples. They never did get it. Little kids come running up to them. What do? Get out of here. The kid's out of here. Go to little kid's church. Jesus said, if you don't become like a little kid, you're out of the kingdom of God. Come on, kids, candy. All right. Look, Jesus Christ, the disciples never did get it. They told the blind guy to shut up. They kept people away from him. They were always saying the wrong thing. He gave them two choices. They'd always choose the wrong one. Isn't that good news? You have to learn that. You can't say to a little baby when he walks, your head is heavy. Watch it. They just have to start walking. Okay, I'm going to lean it back. Just a bit. It takes a while. They have to look at grandma who's having a hard time balancing it herself. It's a struggle to be the Christian faith. It's a struggle to follow Christ. We do fall. We do stumble. We do kind of stagger around. And we have this Jesus who looks at us and goes, oh, man, you did four steps today. That's really good. And then they go, well, okay, two steps. But that's all right. You did four the other day. And when you amortize it all out, it comes out to three. That's not bad. The reality is that you and I have got to recognize that if the church can't be real and honest about who we are, then we're in deep trouble. And I have to tell you some other things. Sometimes only pain and suffering cause us to get desperate enough to seek for God. In my book, Messy Spirituality, I talk about one of the stages of spirituality being getting stuck. Some of you are stuck. You're just not growing. It's like you're stuck in the mud and you just can't seem to go forward and go back. Your prayers feel like they're hitting the ceiling and you're going, what's wrong with me? There's nothing wrong with you. You're stuck. And when you get stuck, the only way you can get unstuck is when you finally decide, I don't want to be stuck anymore. But sometimes being stuck takes a long time to get to that place. Sometimes I just have to wake up one day and go, I am so sick of this. I just don't want to be there anymore. You've had it happen in your marriage, your boyfriend and girlfriends. You've had it happen. Where you just kind of went along and you got further and further apart. And finally, one of you said, okay, what's going on? I can't do this anymore. We're not talking. We haven't talked in 2 weeks. Either let's break up or let's get real and let's talk about what's going on. You've got to finally get sick and tired enough of what's going on. You've got to have enough pain, enough suffering to finally begin to get clarity and see what it is that you and I need to do. One of the other things that really we need to be careful about is how we sentimentalize Christianity so much in life. You know what I mean? I mean, we end up comparing what we know about us to what I don't know about you. So, you know, Billy Graham, I used to think, man, what a guy. I mean, he is. He's an amazing guy. But I put Billy Graham up on this pedestal. And when Billy Graham comes home from a crusade, I don't know what he does. I don't know how he is at home. I don't know how he treats his wife. He may walk in and go, "Meatloaf. We're having meatloaf? I'm saving the world and I'm having meatloaf? I'm out of here." I don't know what Billy Graham does. But because I don't know, I sentimentalize, I romanticize it, and I assume that he's got it all together and treats his wife just perfect and everything's terrific and everything's great, and I'm just a jerk because I know everything about me. But if you knew me, you'd feel pretty good about yourself. But because you don't know me, it's easy for us to kind of sentimentalize and get it all out of whack and suddenly real. We're comparing all the wrong things. I remember the first time I met Henry Nouwen. Man, I was so excited to meet Henry Nouwen. I'd read his book, In the Name of Jesus. Oh, what a book. I mean, that guy, oh, man, he's a saint. He was unbelievable. And I called him up, and he actually talked to me on the phone. I'm going, "I'm talking to Henry Nouwen, saint of the world." There's organ music playing in the background. I can hear it. And he invited us to come up and spend a week with him. I was so excited, and I invited my friends, and we drove there. And he said you know, they're in Toronto at this L'Arche community, and before he died. And I remember, you know, we all got in the plane. I didn't realize that Toronto was so big. And by the time we got to his house, it was 3 hours after we left the airport. We were 2 hours late. But I didn't care. I was going to meet my mentor, Henry Nouwen. And I remember knocking on the door, and he opens the door, and I knew it was him. And I start to say, "Oh, Mr. Nouwen." Before I could say it, he goes, "Where have you been? You're 2 hours late. You ruined dinner. It's been a total disaster. I don't know what we're going to do with you. I send everybody home. We had to redo the schedule. I don't know. Come on in. We'll figure it out." Man, I was so mad. I wanted to grab him and go, "You know, I read a really good book. You need to read it. It's called In the Name of Jesus. You wrote it." I was so disappointed that he was human, that he had anxiety, that he was neurotic, that he was all these things. He was the most godly man I've ever met, but I'm here to tell you he was also very real, and he had very real flaws, and everybody there knew them and were aware of them. You see, the great thing about marriage, the great thing about it being in love, wow, maybe I'm onto something. Woo, that's scary. I was speaking at the Crystal Cathedral, Robert Schuller's church. He was gone. I wasn't speaking for their regular church. I was just in the other smaller glass cathedral. And I was speaking like I normally do is at night. And I went, and God showed up like that. And all of a sudden, thunder and a giant thing of lightning went across the whole sky. And everybody just went, "Okay, whatever you say." It was really spooky. I have no idea what I was talking about. Oh, yeah. Listen, one other thing. I want to tell you that God will always show up in your life. The more real you are and the more honest you are, God will show up and find ways to affirm you in ways you never thought possible, you never thought could happen. And I think most of us are so afraid of being real because that our realness will separate us from God when in fact it's the exact opposite. I always joke about the fact that I got kicked out of both Bible colleges and that I don't have a seminary degree and that I'm still a pastor of this little dinky church and all that kind of stuff. But the truth were known. I'm very insecure about it. I really would like to have an ordination paper sitting on my wall that says I'm a real pastor. I really would have liked to have gone to a seminary so I could wear those big robes and look so godly. Actually, most people say I look like Moses or something, or Jerry Garcia, one or the other. I can't remember. And I thought to myself, I have always wanted that, and I feel so insecure that I don't have that little piece of paper on my wall. So I'm speaking. I get invited to speak to a group of Seventh-day Adventist ministers. And I'm speaking about youth work. That's why they let me come, because I'm not a Seventh-day Adventist. But they said, as long as he talks about youth work, that's okay. Well, I get there, and I realize that these ministers are like most ministers. They're hurting like crazy. How would you like to be a pastor? How would you like to be a vicar? How would you like to be a minister and live under all the expectations that people have about you? In fact, my company puts on pastors' conferences. I love to do that because we don't have anything on the program. We tell them to go play golf, lay down, just relax. Drives them crazy. And one of the things we do, we get up there at the front and we make this announcement. We're 2,000 ministers are sitting out there and we say, "Now listen, if your marriage is in trouble, don't go to a seminar on marriage. Go get a bottle of wine, go to your room, stay there for 4 days, buy the tapes on your way out and tell the church you had a great time. These guys are all going, what? You're giving me permission to spend 4 days in the room with my wife? Yes! That's what normal people do. That's what you do when you need to spend time with your wife. You spend time with your wife. You don't go to a seminar on how to spend time with your wife. You do it. And I believe that the more we can be honest, so I'm this minister, and he's asleep, isn't he? He's totally asleep. Lord, bring him a nightmare right now. Just move into his... I'm kidding. Sort of. Anyway, when you and I become... So ministers freak me out because I can't imagine how they live. So I start talking about my church and I see all these ministers crying and I think to myself, forget about talking about youth work. I'm just going to talk about the church. So that's what I did for the weekend. On the final deal, they say to me, hey, Mike, before you leave, after your last talk, we want to give you a little something. Now, I've done a lot of camps in 40 years. You know what you get when you go to a camp? You get a T-shirt. I got 600 T-shirts. My kids have had pajamas from all of them. They use those T-shirts. They love those T-shirts. I know they're going to give me another T-shirt, which is cool, and it's great, and it's nice. But so I think, okay. So afterward, I come up there, and they're standing there, and they say, you know, you've been telling us all week how you don't have a seminary degree, and you're not a minister, and you're not ordained, and all that kind of stuff. And we're sick and tired of hearing you say that. And as far as I know, in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, this has never been done in the history of the church, but we called our headquarters for the weekend, and we've talked back and forth for quite a long time. And we're going to ordain you right now in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I mean, I was stunned. And you think I was stunned. The other ministers out there were going, can we do this? Are we going to be fired? I mean, you know, they don't eat meat. I was smuggling in Big Macs all the whole weekend. I mean, it was unbelievable. So these guys all get up and they lay hands on me and they ordain me in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Unbelievable. I had to go back to my church. Can you imagine? I said, I've got good news and I've got bad news. Good news is I'm ordained. Bad news is we're meeting on Saturdays. But I thought to myself, what an incredible gift they just gave me. I've got the little card in my wallet that says I'm ordained by the Seventh-day Adventist. That doesn't always help when I'm in a Baptist church, but it's kind of cool to have. It's a cool thing to have, and it was a wonderful gift. And it was though God just kind of showed up and said, all right, you worry about being ordained, then I'm taking care of it. I'm thinking, couldn't it have just been like a Presbyterian church? No. God always has a little twist to what he does. But somehow he got the message to me, look, I ordained you. You're ordained from me. I'll take care of the little detail stuff. And I'm here to tell you, all of you out there, that's what God is waiting to do. He's looking at you going, quit impersonating yourself. Quit trying to be somebody you're not. You be who you're meant to be. It's a great story. I'll close with this. A gal by the name of Margaret, she went to a real small school. It was a one-room schoolhouse where they had kindergarten all the way up to like 12th grade. I don't know what grades, how you grade your high schools, but anyway, it was up through like 16, 17 years old. She had 26 students in the class. And the teacher was one of those teachers, I think we've all had one like that. We've had a teacher that should have retired a few years before, and they're still there, and they're mean, and they don't like certain people, and when they don't like them, they go after them. Maybe you are one of those people. Well, Margaret was one of those people. She was always riding Margaret. So one recess, all the kids came back in, and Margaret was a little late. And the teacher was fed up. And when Margaret came in, she said, Margaret, I've had it with you. I've told you not to be on time. Get up here to the front of the class. She stood up in the front of the class. She said, boys and girls, I've erased the blackboard. I'm going to give each of you a piece of chalk, and I want you to come up to this blackboard, and I want you to write on that blackboard something bad about Margaret. 26 students walked up to that blackboard and wrote, Margaret is stupid. Margaret is ugly. Margaret is fat. Margaret is this. Margaret is that. And you know what? She was now 50 years old, and she still, in her mind, remembered every single thing that happened that day. She'd lived with it for over 50 years, and she needed therapy, and she finally went to a therapist. And after 2 years of therapy, meeting once a week to deal with this whole experience and what it did to her, how she ended up living out everything that those kids had written on that blackboard, the counselor said, okay, Margaret, he said, I think our counseling time is over. I think you've made it through. He said, but just to make sure, I want you to tell me the story one more time. I want to see if you can get through it without crying. So she told the story one more time. She described what each of the kids was wearing. She talked about what they wrote on the blackboard. She talked about her experience. And when she got all done, she was able to keep from totally crying, and she sort of just took a deep breath. And the counselor looked at her and said, "Margaret, you forgot one of the students." She said, "No, I didn't. No, I did not. I know that story. I've been there. I've read it over and over again. I didn't miss one student. No, everybody that was in that room, I got." He said, "No, Margaret, you forgot somebody. They're sitting in the back. Look at him. His name's Jesus. He's getting up. He's walking towards your teacher. She's handing him a piece of chalk. He's taking it, but he's grabbing the eraser. Look, Margaret, he's erasing the blackboard. Look what he's doing. He's writing, 'Margaret is beautiful. Margaret is brilliant. Margaret is fun,' and on and on and on." May I say to you, when you're honest and when you're real, Jesus Christ picks up the chalk and writes on your heart who you really are. And you and I no longer have to impersonate ourselves. God bless you. Thank you very much.